This weekend, while hundreds of thousands rallied on the Mall invoking the spirit of Dr. King, a man who King hired to direct strategies for direct action during the infancy stages of the movement delivered an address one block away at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Dr. James M. Lawson was a draft resister during the Korean War and was sentenced to 3 years in prison for refusing to enter the military. After being paroled from prison, he went to India and studied with Gandhi. When Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus in 1955, he returned home to the U.S. and joined Dr. King in the struggle. Peace Watch editor Lona Elias captured his remarks on tape.
So let me say very quickly then a point that I hope that you will remember, and that is this, that you and I do not owe wherever we are in life today because of the war on terrorism or the war on Iraq or World War II or World War I or the wars in Vietnam or Guatemala, El Salvador or Korea or elsewhere. That is a lie that will prove to be the destruction of the people unless we penetrate it. No war produced religious liberty in the United States. No war. No war produced freedom of the press. No war produced the right of the people of peaceful assembly. I have no idea what the founding fathers thought they were doing in either 1776 or 1789, but when they wrote those visions into those two great documents, they were not evident in the world around them. They were not evident in the 13 colonies by any means. But somehow they apparently were struck perhaps by a star from the outer edges of our universe. And that star insisted that they not dream based on what they saw, but based on the great hungers and needs of the human heart. Our liberty and freedom has come because of the struggle of people like yourselves. If you will look at the history of America, you'll see freedom of worship, Mary Dyer, Roger Williams, a great range of names that no Americans recognize, but the folk who were hung in the Boston Square, preached out of the jail cells in Charlottesville, Virginia, and caused James Madison and Thomas Jefferson to write the first freedom of religion amendment to the Virginia Charter. That's how it came about. The right of peaceful assembly was because of the abolitionist movement prior to 1860 of men and women, free Negroes, free men and women out of slavery with white church people of different kinds and white abolitionists who did the first freedom rides in 1840 in New England and Pennsylvania and New York as they prevented the Jim Crow curtain from being applied in the trains and in the carriages. I want to push very hard that war will destroy us with its meanness, with its demonizing of some people, with our denying the equality of all human life, the equality of life. Which is all the more reason why you must understand that what King represents is the future of this country, if it has a great future. The need for we the people to struggle for justice and truth. For it's clear that the president and the Congress and the governors and the state legislators, who are among the best that money can buy anywhere in the world, have not represented us and will not represent the life of the people. But I quickly come back to the fact that the conscience of this nation was lifted in a fashion that caused millions of people to tell the presidents and Congress and governors, it's time that we rid ourselves of segregation and racism, and we begin to march deliberately towards a time where, in fact, discrimination in the public marketplace and the private marketplaces are eliminated, that signs come down and the rest of it. And the date I would have you remember for that fact was May 10th, 1960, because we in Nashville set as our goal in 1959 not lunch counter sit-ins, but we set as our goal the desegregation of downtown Nashville. We wanted the signs to come down everywhere. We wanted jobs in places where we were always denied to begin to open. But the question that evolved in the movement by the mid-60s, formed by 1966-67, was where do we go from here, chaos or community? We had the notion that our generation of the human race had achieved the power of the universe to commit suicide, either with a bang or with a whimper. For the first time, human beings had the ability in the second half of the 20th century to destroy ourselves. And you should know that the United States was the leading figure in having submarines in the deep ocean circling the oceans and the earth with nuclear warheads on missiles. Martin King and others of us were persuaded that unless the human family was able to find itself and seize power from the heads of globalization, the heads of the imperialism and colonialism of the last 500 years, unless that could happen, we would push the earth, push the nations towards the suicide and self-destruction. But on the other side of the coin, we also saw that indeed, if we could corral power that was available and use it not for hate and demonizing and hurt, we would create a foundation for the human family that certainly would be the will of God and certainly would be the hope of the masses of the people of the earth. And so this is the question that I would have you give your attention to. Where do we go from here, chaos or community? That is what the movement of the 60s represented at its best. But the central thrust of the struggle of the 50s-60s is about whether or not we will leave the Clintons and the Bush to manage America and thus create chaos, more chaos. But very quickly, where do we go from here, chaos or community? If we want to go from community, may I suggest three things. One, you and I must withdraw from any of our consent to the status quo that promotes policies of racism, sexism, materialism, greed, materialism, and the like. And you can say, no, you do not have my consent to raise taxes in Maryland or Virginia or California by cutting education and health care for the poor. You don't have my consent. I am not that kind of human being. We can say no. So the first thing is to say, I withdraw my consent, George Bush, and we ought to write George Bush that, and we ought to write our governors and our senators, no, if that's where you are, no, no, no. Secondly, I'd like to suggest to you that we must learn in the midst of our very violent society what it is to be nonviolent personally and in terms of other people. Nonviolence is not a wimpishness whereby you run away, or is it a wimpishness whereby in the midst of conflict and difficulty you acquiesce and let the oppression live? Nonviolence is the power is to use power in such a fashion that out of the conflict comes a new little burst of justice or enlargement of the human soul or a new burst of liberty and opportunity for all. And then thirdly, let me suggest to you that if you would emulate King and honor the movement that he represents, and you cannot honor Martin King if you do not honor the tens of thousands of people who surrounded the movement and made the movement happen, then I urge you, if you are not a part of some group that's organizing for social, political, economic change in the United States, get involved.
Dr. James M. Lawson, who collaborated civil disobedience strategies with Dr. King, he delivered his remarks last weekend at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. There are nearly 40 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and virtually all of their lives have been touched somewhat by the teachings of Dr. King. But it was U.S. Representative John Conyers of Michigan who wrote the bill making King's birthday a national holiday.
I started in the civil rights movement before I became a government official. As a lawyer, I went south with SCLC, and particularly in Mississippi, somehow I got assigned there. And my job was principally defending civil rights workers who had been arrested or incarcerated or were otherwise in prisons trying to get out.
When did you meet Dr. King?
Let's see. I probably met Dr. King in some of his many trips to Detroit early on. Detroit, outside of New York and Los Angeles, maybe Chicago, was a major center for the King initiative that was going on. It was very active. The church and the civil rights movement and the NAACP people and labor were all highly supportive of Dr. King in the metropolitan Detroit area. And so we saw him frequently. And as a matter of fact, we got to meet Andy Young and Ralph Abernathy, who frequently went to fundraising events when he couldn't get there. It was during between 58 and onward we got to know each other.
And so what about the young Dr. King in those days? What kind of an impression did he make on you?
Total. To me, he was the man from the very beginning. I mean, he was inspirational. He was committed. As we look back on it now, Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Abernathy, was the head of the new emerging civil rights movement. But as soon as King got there, it became clear that King's star was going to go much further than Abernathy's. Mm-hmm. And Abernathy quickly acquiesced and made himself the number two person.
And you were an attorney at the time.
That's right.
What drew you into the civil rights movement? Was it Dr. King's charisma and personality and style?
Well, my dad's career in the labor movement actually prepared me for the emerging civil rights movement.
Now, I'm told, then, I believe reading somewhere, where Rosa Parks was actually employed by you as your secretary?
Well, yes, she was my administrative assistant for many years. Rosa came to Detroit just before my campaign for Congress began in the 60s. Nothing was more energizing and ultimately the result of a victory for me than the fact that this little lady who started the Montgomery bus boycott was sitting in my campaign.
How close did you eventually become to Dr. King?
I went to King's house quite frequently. I knew all the kids when they were just tots. And so I had a close relationship to King. I talked to him. I met with him. I went with him around the South. I knew his lawyers and his staff and the SCLC people and Walter Fauntroy and all the people there. I considered myself a dues-paying member of the civil rights movement. I was with King in Detroit. I was with him in Washington March. I was with him all the time.
And wasn't it you, Congressman, who actually drafted the legislation for the Martin Luther King Holiday Act?
It was me, yes.
Inspired, I'm certain, by your...
Well, I thought of what would be the most fitting tribute for the most impressive human being I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was that there should be a national legal holiday celebrating his birth. And so I called Coretta King to get her blessings on this undertaking, and I introduced the bill 4 days after he was assassinated.
And so how long was the struggle to get that bill passed?
15 and one half years.
How would you rank that in terms of your political accomplishments?
It would probably be number one. I'm thinking of the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act that Senator McGovern and Coretta Scott King, who had stepped in to fill her husband's shoes in the labor movement, who were trying to create jobs.
U.S. Representative John Conyers of Michigan. Martin Luther King is usually remembered for his March on Washington speech, but he also devoted much of the end of his life to the Poor People's Campaign and in opposition to the Vietnam War. Larry Binsky, host of Pacifica's Sunday Salon program, spoke with William Pepper, author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. He talked about the response King received.
He was a critical force and an energizer of the movement for peace. When he formalized his opposition to the war in the speech 1 year to the day before his death on the 4th of April, 1967 at Riverside Church in New York. That speech cost him a great deal. It cost SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his organization, an enormous amount of money. Those funds were withdrawn drastically and quickly because he became now an anti-establishment, unacceptable figure, even amongst the leaders of the civil rights movement. He took the position because, for him, it was the only position he could take. When I returned from Vietnam and published an article called The Children of Vietnam and Ramparts in January 67, replete with photographs that I had been able to take as I wandered around the country and lived in shelters and camps. When he read that piece, Bernard Lee, his bodyguard, was with him at Atlanta Airport. And Bernard said, as he went through his mail and he hit this magazine and he started to thumb through it and he saw the photographs of the burned and mangled bodies of children and women and civilians, he pushed his food away. And Bernard inquired about the food and he said, no, it's not that. He said, I could never enjoy a meal again so long as this continues. Then he asked to meet with me, and I opened the files to him of that were much more extensive than anything that was published, and he openly wept. From that time on, I agreed to work with him the last year of his life in the development of the National Conference for New Politics, and became then a political umbrella organization, which was designed to provide a political alternative to the Johnson a ticket. And of course, we never knew at the time, but it was taken over by and was infiltrated by a government who used South Chicago black organizations and, funded by the Labor Department and the Blackstone Rangers, particularly the gang, to come in and dragoon the entire black delegation. There were 5,000 delegates at that convention on Labor Day 67. I sat back down next to Ben Spock, as I recall, and I was passed a note from behind, and the note said, make sure he leaves as soon as he finishes this address, or we will take him hostage and humiliate him before the eyes of the world. They wanted Martin King out of there. They didn't want him to be a force for unification or a force to tie together the disparate groups and factions of the movement. They wanted him gone. And I had it was the government of the United States, but they were operating through a variety of forces, including the Daily Machine in Chicago and the Southwest Poverty, the local poverty organization. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, my view, for two basic reasons. One, we discussed earlier, his coming out against the war was a seminal event that went to the bottom line of a number of the major corporations that were doing very well in the war, relating from construction companies to all of the armaments and the arms manufacturers. And it was this had serious economic consequences for those corporations. The second, but probably more powerful reason, in my view, was that he was determined to bring 500,000 people to Washington in the spring of that year, and they were going to camp in the shadow of the Washington Memorial. It wasn't a march. It was going to be an encampment. And they were going to visit in various numbers and stages their congressmen and senators on a daily basis and try to get back the programs, social welfare programs, the funding that had been eliminated because of the priority of the war. And they were going to truck up there at the Capitol every day and do that. The Army believed he was going to lose control of that group. The Army believed that that group would become increasingly angry and rebellious, and that the more violently inclined urban leaders who would be present in the encampment, the village, would take it over, and they would have a revolution on their hands and didn't have enough troops to put it down.
Larry Binsky, host of Pacifica's Sunday Salon, speaking with William Pepper, author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. During times of crisis in our history, artists and writers often serve as the conscience of the people. One of the voices of defiance that has been resonating for several decades is poet and activist Nikki Giovanni. She dropped into our Peace Watch studio last weekend and recalled her meeting with Dr. King and the influence he had on her life as an activist and poet.
I've written quite a few poems about Martin, but this particular poem, and I must apologize to your audience for my laryngitis.
That's okay.
This particular poem was written specifically for the Smithsonian exhibition In the Spirit of Martin. Mm-hmm. And when I was invited to join that effort, this was a labor of love from all of the artists. We all volunteered our services. And when I was invited to join it, I wanted to bring Martin up to put him in his time and maybe take him a little bit forward, mm-hmm. because everybody just deals with the March on Washington speech, which is always referred to as the I Have a Dream speech. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the We Are Here to Cash a Check speech. And the top part of that speech is important. And so I kind of tease the rappers all the time because I say it all the time. See, I think the whole March on Washington speech should be rapped. I think that the rapper should, we are here to cash a check, you know. I think they should rap it and, get it up to date. And, of course, in the poem, I'm not only putting Martin in the 50s, which is where he resides with Ed Sullivan, with Father Knows Best. You know, Martin came out of a cultural tradition and, of course, changed that culture. Mm-hmm. But also to bring him up to date because it is I shouldn't say fact, but it is most likely if Martin were alive today, he would have braids because he was he was a very modern guy, you know. Mm-hmm. I doubt that we could have gotten him to go blonde, but we definitely would have gotten him braids. And I would have bet he would have a tattoo, you know, just because the kids used to tease him. Everybody called him Doc. Mm-hmm. And we'd say, Doc, you got to have a tattoo. And he would laugh, but I'm sure he would end up with a tattoo.
That's very intriguing, Dr. King with a tattoo and braids.
Yeah, because he was a real person. He wasn't he's an icon because of what he did. But Martin Luther King Jr. was a real person. Mm-hmm. He was just a 26-year-old young man. I mean, a child, 26, is mm-hmm. very young, mm-hmm. when he became the voice of the Montgomery Improvement Association. And in becoming the voice of the MIA, he became, in many respects, the voice of Black America, which is going to lead him to a mm-hmm. Nobel Prize.
When did you first meet him?
Oh.
You remember that day?
I remember the day, but I don't remember the date. He came to Knoxville College. I was living with my grandparents in Knoxville, Tennessee, and he came to give the commencement address at Knoxville College. Mm-hmm. And grandmother said to me, we have to go to the graduation. Well, all of these things in a small town like Knoxville are big. Dr. King was big at that time anyway, but mm-hmm. everybody goes to everybody's funeral and everybody goes to, what you do is go to churches on Sundays. Mm-hmm. So grandmother said, we have to go. Grandfather was 20 years older than grandmother, and public events sometimes were not good for him. Mm-hmm. But grandmother said to me, we have to go. Dr. King is a great man. And so we went, and grandmother, I don't want you to think she was pushy, because she wasn't pushy, but she was kind of focused. Mm-hmm. And so she decided she wanted to sit up front. Mm-hmm. And she kind of moved everyone out, and we sat up front. Uh-huh. So when he finished the speech, he said, now go on up there and shake his hand. And that was the first time I met Martin.
Isn't that something? Yeah. And so did you actually develop a relationship, a political relationship at that point?
No. I'm too young and totally unimportant. I mean, he would speak to me. I don't know if he knew me, just remember the face, mm-hmm. because he saw so many people. We were not, we didn't hang out. We weren't intimate. Mm-hmm. And Martin was a bit older, as you know, than we were when mm-hmm. that age. If he were alive now, our ages wouldn't matter. We could hang out if that's the case. But in those days, see, I was in SNCC, mm-hmm. which Martin had sent Ella Baker to start. And Ella Baker called everybody to North Carolina, and she really directed it, but it made everybody think that they were doing it. Mm-hmm. And student nonviolent coordinator, Yes. Coordination
Committee.
The
mm-hmm.
committee was founded. And so we were just kids, but, you know, you would see people as you do now, mm-hmm. see people, and they know your face or you know theirs, and you always speak, and how's it going, and right, wishing them well.
What do you think Dr. King would say about this impending war with Iraq if he were alive today?
Well, I think it's really clear that is not a thought. King's already said the war is a stupid, bad idea. He said it better than that. And he also pointed out that an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. But Bush wants to fight in Iraq because of money. Some of it's ego, I'm sure, but a lot of it is controlling the golf course for oil. And he doesn't mind sacrificing my son, your son, and the sons of some poor whites to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So he calls up the reserves because he knows if he starts a draft, there'll be a reaction. The rich white boys don't want to be drafted to go over to fight a war in Vietnam over oil so that Ken Lay can, what, buy another mansion.
Dr. Nikki Giovanni is the recipient of 16 honorary doctorate degrees and is presently teaching at Virginia Tech University. Sweet Honey in the Rock.
I feel death and doctor like a spaceship on a new planet.
Voyagers, all we were.
We were the aliens walking up to the 70s. A Holocaust people on the move looking out from dark eyes.
We were young bloods spinning hip syllables while saluting death in a country neutral with pain.
And our children saw the mirage of plenty spilling from money-mad sands. And they ran toward the desert.
And the gods of sand made them immune to words that strengthen the breast.
And they became scavengers.
Walking on
and
the
you
earth.
Can see them
native
play.
Songs
hide
running
and
on their knees.
Reinventing slavery on that
slope.
You can
chain.
See them on Times Square in New York City.
7-Eleven, 12 and 13 year old bodies, two suburban forefathers.
Young fishing,
no cops are going on these mean streets.
Great God, what a morning will be something.
I want you to know that decade failed. Like a stone on our eyes.
Our movements, rhythms, the love from the lights. Our rhythms, the rhythms, the love from the lights.
New birth, knocking at the womb, kept us walking and walking and walking and walking.
We crossed the cities while a backlash of judges tried to turn us into molds.
Lack
the words of reverse racism. Oh, we knew.
Knowing was like a sister's embrace.
We crossed the land where famine was fed and
where black stomachs exploded on the world's day.
While many bombed their eyes and tongues in gold.
But we knew,
oh, we knew.
A Letter to Martin, Sweet Honey in the Rock. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Lona Elias and Scott Gurian. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Keith Chalgion, Ron Pinchback, Reem Kathuda, and Bentha Berkland. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening, and happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Dangerous days, Martin, when nuclear potent generals...